Welcome to the Atlantic Council Events Podcast. The Atlantic Council serves the global community by bringing together world leaders, foreign policy experts, and great thinkers to shape today's policy choices and navigate the global challenges of the 21st century. In the following program, the Atlantic Council launches the report, The Kremlin's Trojan Horses, Russian Influence in France, Germany, and the United Kingdom. The report exposes the Kremlin's networks of political influence in Europe's core. The event took place on November 16th, 2016.
So good morning, everyone. I'm going to go ahead and get started. My name is Alina Polyakova. I'm the Deputy Director and at the Eurasia Center here at the Council and also Senior Fellow for Europe here as well. And it's really my pleasure to be part of this panel with this very distinguished group of discussants and panelists to introduce our new report called The Kremlin's Trojan Horses, Russian Influence in France, Germany, and the UK, which all of you can pick up outside if you haven't already. So I just want to say a few words about this report. I'm one of the authors on it, but of course I'm joined here by two of the other authors, Marlene Laurel and Neil Barnett, and Stefan Meister, who wrote the Germany case, wasn't able to be here from Berlin. But Andreas Umland will be stepping in to talk a little bit about Germany. But before I go over to our panelists and introduce them to all of you, I want to talk a little bit about why we wanted to do this project. And the impetus behind this report is really to make the point that Western democracies are not immune from Russian influence. And we started this project long before a lot of the revelations came out about Russia's potential influence in our own elections here in the United States during the campaign, hacking of the DNC and other private email servers of Democratic officials. And now our focus is on Europe's core. That's Germany, France, and the UK, countries that the US has traditionally seen as allies. They've been the beacon of liberal democracy, liberal capitalism as well in the EU. And many people, when they ask about how do we understand Russian influence, and what does it matter, they want to follow the money. They want to know about financial relationships. So is the Russian government funding individuals, groups, or organizations? That information, except in very rare cases, which I'm sure Marlene will talk about, is almost impossible to find. And there's a reason for that. These kinds of relationships or network are intentionally opaque. They're intentionally hidden because they're more effective when they are hidden and opaque. And that is the point of this report, is to draw out the individuals, the organizations, sort of built relationships with the Russian government, looking at how those relationships have developed and what effect they've had on policy. And I really encourage you to look at the policy recommendations, which are, of course, at the end of this report as well, that I think are incredibly relevant and useful for particularly Germany, UK, and France, but the EU more broadly. So before I jump into the details of the report, I'm going to quickly introduce our distinguished panel here. So to my left, as already mentioned, is Neil Barnett, who's Chief Executive Officer of ISTEC Associates. He's also the author of the case in the United Kingdom. To his immediate left, I have Dr. Mitchell Ornstein, who's not only Senior Fellow at the Foreign Policy Institute, but also Professor and Chair at the Department of Slavic Languages and Literatures at the University of Pennsylvania, and also has published extensively on this particular topic of far-right and Russian influence and the connection between the Russian government and populism. And then, of course, immediately to Mitchell's left is Dr. Marlene Laurel, who's one of the authors. She wrote the case on France, and she's the director of the Central Asia Program and also associate director of the Institute for European, Russian, and Eurasian Studies at the Elliott School of International Affairs here at George Washington University, and of course an expert on Eurasianism and Russian politics more broadly. I'm delighted to have you here with us today, Marlene. And to Marlene's left, I have Dr. Andreas Umland, who we caught very surreptitiously on his trip to DC, one of the few. So we're lucky to have him. Dr. Umland is a senior research fellow at the Institute for Euro-Atlantic Cooperation in Kiev. He spends a lot of his time in Berlin as well, and is an expert both on Ukrainian politics and I would say German politics and just broader Eurasian-European relations as well. So thanks, Andreas. And to Andreas's left, I have Josh Rogan, who is the columnist for the Washington Post. I'm sure many of you have been reading his recent articles, particularly those on Russian influence in during our own campaign cycle, and he's done some amazing investigative work on that topic as well. Thanks for joining us, Josh. And then last but certainly not least, again, surreptitiously caught from, via Indiana, but from Hungary, is Dr. Peter Krakow, who's now a Fulbright professor at Central Eurasian Studies Department and a faculty member of the Russian Eastern European Institute, Indiana University, but usually director of the Political Capital Institute in Budapest, and has followed the developments in Budapest and the rise of Orban very, very closely, and we're lucky to have him. So I want to actually start with Mitchell. Mitchell, you've been writing a lot about these issues, and I want to ask you to give us a sense about the terminology we use in this report. So the report is called Trojan Horses, the Kremlin's Trojan Horses, and this is how we as a group have chosen to define the kinds of relationships that we see developing in Western European countries. You've also used this term in some of your own work, but others have also used the idea of useful idiots, agents of influence, the old Soviet term. So how would you talk about these pro-Kremlin groups that we see emerging in Western European and Eastern European countries? And do they pose a serious threat, mm-hmm. you think, to the EU?
Well, yes, I mean, it's quite clear. I think it should be quite clear after the US election that, yes, this does pose a serious threat. In terms of the terminology, I think it's an interesting question. So you know that that I've authored an article called Trojan Horses in EU Foreign Policy. And in that article, together with my co-author Dan Kelman, we were trying to identify a specific phenomenon, which is the use of member state governments, pro-Russian member state governments by Russia to try and undermine particular policy positions of the EU Council, for instance, or the EU Commission. And I think in this report, you use the term a bit more broadly to indicate as Trojan horses, people who are either you can prove or prospectively in the, presumptively in the employ of Moscow or representing Moscow in some rather direct linkage. Right, so that they either have a news show on Russia Today, which means that the Russian government may be paying them, or they have some sort of sponsorship that is coming, for instance, through an organization, a Russian cooperation organization, that you might say is similar to a kind of front organization that existed in, you know, under Soviet times. And so for me, I think Trojan horse terminology brings up a couple of implications. I mean, one is this covert nature, right? It's sort of the placement of a sort of enemy force in a way, right, within the walls of the city. And in that respect, I believe you can speak of some of the agents of influence in that terminology. That would be correct. But I think you would want to probably restrict it to those who you can tell are placed, and those who you can tell are being placed covertly, at least to some extent. The issue, I think, it comes, and I think this is something we can discuss a bit more, when you there's many people in Europe, as well as in the United States that we see, who are certainly not being paid by the Kremlin, and yet are taking pro-Russian stances on foreign policy. And these people, you know, are very impolitely, you know, referred to as useful idiots. I think it was a Leninist term, right? But you know, I think more, you know, accurately, you can say that, you know, there's a certain zeitgeist right now. There's a certain opinion. There's a lot of people who are coming around to, or will come around to, or are thinking along the lines of, you know, sort of an appeasement or a friendly relationship towards Russia, or attracted, have an elective affinity towards Putin or towards authoritarian rule, conservative authoritarian rule, who may join forces with Russian foreign policy without being a direct agent of influence. And I think that distinction is important, both in terms of how we use a sort of accusative terminology, but also more broadly in terms of how we analyze the situation and the sort of dangers that are in. The danger is not only that there are these agents of influence, the danger is that of winning the hearts and minds of quite a lot of people in Europe.
I do want to come back to this question of how do we understand this seeming, you know, pro-Russian turn in politics and policy not just in Western Europe to some extent, but of course also in Central Eastern Europe and what we can call sort of the gray zone of Ukraine, Moldova, et cetera. We just had elections in Bulgaria and Moldova that brought in pro-Russian governments. Estonia is also teetering with the collapse of their own government. And I do want to talk about that, so thanks for bringing that up. But I want to give Marlene a chance to discuss France. I think France is one of the most interesting cases in this report because it's been so much more publicized, the relationship between the National Front and potentially this Russian funded bank from the Czech Republic. As all of you might know, there was a big story last spring where Marine Le Pen admitted to receiving funding, I think, of about 9 million euros from a Czech-based Russian-funded bank. But it doesn't seem to have hurt her at the polls very much at all. So could you talk a little bit about how this particular incident, this very stark admission of financial connections and support, was received in France specifically, to contextualize it a bit? And how would you describe the degree of Russian influence in French politics today?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if I can just kind of follow the discussion we just began. I think this notion of Trojan horses is a kind of very difficult one analytically. I'm not sure it's the right one, because the majority of people who will be discussing here of this pro-Russian European political figure, they are not puppets of the Putin's regime. They have their own interest, their own political perception of the world. They have their own popular legitimacy. It's just that their own vision of the world is overlapping with Russia's one. But I think they have their own agenda, and it's very rare where really you can identify people that you can really see as kind of puppet, really created artificially by the Russian regime. So I think we should be very careful, because in the majority of cases, these personalities have their own legitimacy in the local political agenda. And the French case is a good example of that, because the success of the National Front globally in French politics has nothing to do with Russia, because the French public opinion is not very much interested in what is happening around Russia and Ukraine, just because it's not part of the general political culture among the French general opinion. So it's really deep issues, domestic issues, that make the National Front so successful, unfortunately, all this last year. And when the bank loan was make kind of open and recognized by the National Front itself, it created a kind of shock among the French political leadership, but not really among the French population, because that's not the kind of issue that people are looking at. So I think that's one aspect. Another one that I think is important to understand the French general context is that you have this historical Russian diaspora present in France, very much active in the political and the cultural landscape, and they are very much representing Russia's interest on many aspects. The fact that a few weeks ago France inaugurated the biggest Orthodox cathedral in Paris created this one a lot of discussion, because that was really interpreted as a dangerous soft power tool coming from the Russian Orthodox Church and therefore from the Kremlin. So this case of the Orthodox Church was much more discussed than the bank loan to the National Front. And then more globally, which I think is important and it may be very specific to France, is that you have two geopolitical elements that make that a relatively large part of the French political landscape, the mainstream one, is kind of not pro-Russian, but in favor of reconciliation with Russia. The first one is that you have this kind of de Gaulle, Gaullist tradition of being very cautious toward the US, the transatlantic commitment, and wanted a kind of continental Europe politics. It's still very much influential among the French military circles, for example, this Gaullist tradition. And then globally, the French foreign policy is so much oriented toward relationship with the Middle East, French politics in policy in the Arab world, that really what is the situation in Syria and globally, the collapse of the Middle East, is so much important for the French foreign policy that it kind of pushed Russia on the side, or on the contrary, it pushed many French mainstream politicians to consider that they want to reconcile with Russia, because they think Russia can be a partner in trying to manage the situation in the Middle East. So that's why you have these growing Russophile groups very clearly visible among the Republican Party, and especially around Nicolas Sarkozy and François Fillon. They have been really very much involved in trying to build new, to try to reconcile with Russia. So that's a totally different trend from the Marine Le Pen one.
So I actually want to pass it over to Andreas, and because Marlene has started mentioning a really interesting point, which is about how historical legacy and politics play into the current dynamics. I think that's important for France, or the Gaullist tradition, as Marlene was saying, but also in Germany, where we have this tradition of realpolitik, and of course the term, you know, Putin verstehe, Russland verstehe, you know, understanding of Russia. It's a German term that has entered, you know, our English discourse as well. So Andreas, I know you're stepping in for Stefan very, very graciously, but how does this historical legacy of working with Russia, Germany has a special relationship with Russia, you could say, how does that really affecting what we're seeing now, particularly with the rise of AfD, which I think has been very cautious in making any public statements regarding Russia? Maybe it doesn't matter in some ways, because Marlene was saying these are domestically driven processes. These politicians and political groups are not puppets, and I don't think we're trying to imply that in any way here. But can you contextualize what's happening in Germany now, given this history of special relations with Russia?
In a way, the paradox is that we know about this special relationship, but still within the European context, the EU context, Germany nowadays appears as a hawk concerning the sanctions towards Russia in relation to Ukraine. And that's even more surprising in view of, I think, two peculiarities in Germany. This is, and I wonder how the other experts here on other countries would compare that to Germany, that in Germany the relationship, this sort of Russian influence on Germany, but also German influence on Russia, is institutionalized to a larger degree, I would say, than in other countries. So the central organ here is an organization called the German Russian Forum, but there are also others, the St. Petersburg Dialogue, which is a sort of German-Russian Valdai Club, you could say, or the Eastern Committee of the German industry. And obviously there are also institutions in other countries that play a certain role between Russia and these countries. But I think the important thing about these institutions that I just mentioned for Germany is that they matter. These are large institutions, influential institutions. So if you compare, for instance, the German-Russian Forum with the German-Ukrainian Forum that I also know, most people wouldn't even know that there is such a thing as a German-Ukrainian Forum, whereas the German-Russian Forum is a quite influential institution. And now there is this new think tank appearing in Berlin called Dialogue of Civilizations, which has several prominent German public figures in its board. The other peculiarity of the German-Russian relationship is this whole special connection between the Putin regime and the Social Democratic Party. And it's, I think, peculiar in two ways. It's a left-centrist party. It's not a radical left party. It's also not a right-centrist party like the Republicans in France. It's also not a far-right party, but it's a left-centrist party. And it's a sort of multifarious relationship. So it goes over several generations. You have this the sympathy on the part of the older generation of the SPD, like it used to be with Egon Bahr and Helmut Schmidt. Then you have this somewhat younger people like Gerhard Schröder, Platzek. You have in the current government people like Sigmar Gabriel. You have also former people from the Friedrich Ebert Foundation, like Professor Peter Schulze, who is now on the board of this supposedly new think tank, which has not been, I think, operational so far, Dialogue of Civilization of Yakunin. So it's a multifarious relationship. And on the background of this, the hawkishness of the current, the relative hawkishness of the current German government is actually quite surprising, because the if you look at this whole tradition, and also of course lots of cultural connections and so on, it's surprising. It can be explained, in my opinion, partly by, I think, what is the main motive in this sort of German policy towards Russia, towards Europe, and towards the world in general, that it's driven by a sort of pro-European pacifistic idealism. That is, I think, what stands behind it. And so often I think people they're sort of very critical of this German foreign policy, but it sort of criticize this idealism by itself. But I think that in a way explains both the former very sort of pro-Russian policy of the same administration as we have now until the Crimea annexation, the modernization partnership, the strategic partnership, all these institutions that I mentioned. But that also explains now this disillusionment in the German government that they've now sort of not only the CDU, even the SPD, people in the SPD like Steinmeier or Erler, they realize that Russia is not part of this sort of pan-European ideal, this sort of peaceful world, which is sort of the main driving force. And of course, there are also other driving forces for this Putin-Versteherei or this Putin understanding, anti-Americanism, very important for the alternative for Germany, the far-right party, also for the left party. The whole issue about World War II, which I think in 2014 was a big misunderstanding, which I think has now clarified. So the Ukrainians in Germany, they've pointed out that, you know, we were also part of this World War II thing. And you know, we've also been Red Army soldiers and so on. And then there are, of course, the financial relationships. You know, Schröder is working for Gazprom, formerly very influential Alexander Rahr, who had the... was heading the sort of Russia section of the German Council of Foreign Relations and has now switched to the German-Russian Forum, works also for Gazprom and lots of other things. And then there's also, I think, part of the story is just sheer provincialism, in world political provincialism, I would call it. Maybe the best expression for this is this whole reference to the Ostpolitik of the 1970s, that somehow these lessons... That was the one moment when post-war Germany sort of had its own policy and its own foreign policy initiative. And so people now refer back to that because there's not much else to refer back to, because Germany was always a minor player until recently in world politics, and they had this Ostpolitik. Now they refer back to that. But I think it's, you know, it's just a misunderstanding, because that was a completely different context. And of course, what followed after the Ostpolitik was then the enormous tensions of the early 1980s, where we were on the brink of a nuclear war, and the Afghanistan and the rockets, the new missiles in Europe, SDI, and so on. So, you know, it's also a little bit a misunderstanding of how world politics works. So this provincialism, I'm afraid, is also part of the story.
But despite that, Germany is very much becoming a foreign policy leader under Merkel, right?
Yes.
And I think what's interesting, what you're describing, and comes out also clearly in the report and in the comments that Merlin has also made, is that we tend to, sort of in the academic expert community, there's a lot of research already being done in the relationship between the fringe populace of the far left and the far right in the relationship with the Russian government. But what you're describing, Merlin, and what you're describing as well, Andreas, is that there is, it's also in the mainstream, right? We can't talk about these people as puppets of the Kremlin or anything like that, but they are also using that relationship to fulfill their own political aims, perhaps, and they're using it to benefit in some way from establishing these kinds of ties with Russia, whether they be economic ties, and in the case of Schröder, for example, perhaps the most famous case, or perhaps, you know, political gains that they could have from being seen as siding with a strong authoritarian leader like Vladimir Putin. So, Neil, I do want to talk about the UK, because all of these things that we've been talking about influence seeping into the mainstream, if you want to call it that, you also describe in your case study in the United Kingdom. You talk about Corbyn as well. Andreas mentioned the SPD, that it is a strange, perhaps odd relationship. You have a central-left political leader and political party that has individuals in it arguing for pro-Russian agenda, perhaps being somewhat apologists at one point about Russian actions in Crimea as well, though perhaps not now as much. So could you tell us a bit more about the UK, and particularly, my sense is that in the report, the UK comes off as in a relatively positive light compared to France and Germany in any case. But it also seems that a lot of the relationships that you seek to describe are relatively opaque. It's very difficult to trace any sort of financial ties, as I mentioned before. But in any case, has the Kremlin actually been successful in building any sort of political influence in the UK specifically, even though it comes off, I think, in a much softer light than France and Germany?
Yeah, well, first I should say I have a cold and I'm losing my voice, so I may sound a bit strange and my voice may disappear, so sorry about that. The strange position with Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party is, I think it's part of a broader phenomenon. It's mirrored with the with Aaron Banks, who's the principal funder of UKIP. And I think what's emerging in the UK is that political parties are being challenged by movements. So, and this presents all kinds of opportunities for opportunistic foreign powers, viz. Russia in this case. Because a movement, it's a moving target. It doesn't have the same regulation and establishment as a political party, and therefore you can do really a lot more with a movement without being held accountable than you can with a political party. So Jeremy Corbyn and Seamus Milne are the leaders of Momentum, which is a radical left movement. He happens to have hijacked the Labour Party and also become the leader of that, but he's above all the leader of Momentum, and he places the interests of Momentum, which and the policies of Momentum, which include being very firmly pro-Russian, above the interests of the Labour Party, and it could be argued that he wants to destroy the Labour Party in some respect. Moving on to Aaron Banks and UKIP. UKIP, for those of you who follow British politics, is in a very strange position. It has one MP. It's in complete disarray. In a sense, it's a joke. On the other hand, UKIP won the referendum. You can say, you can read it that way.
And Farage is, you know, now the bridge, supposedly, between the UK and the US.
He is, yeah.
Or he's trying to position himself in that way.
Allegedly, yeah. And the figure behind UKIP in terms of funding is Aaron Banks. Now, I didn't go into huge detail about Banks in the report, partly because of space, but I wrote an article about him in the American Interest, headlined Who Funded Brexit, which has a lot more detail. And if anyone's interested in it, I say have a look at that. Banks and Farage remain on very good terms. And in fact, Banks was with Farage when he visited your president-elect a few days ago. But Banks is now saying that he favours replacing UKIP with what he calls a movement, a popular movement. So here you have the two poles of Russian influence in British politics, both of which are essentially movements. Banks is yet to fully emerge, but I have very little doubt that it will emerge. Banks put nearly $10 million, about £6.5 million, into Brexit through leave.eu and grassroots out. He donated several millions to UKIP before that. He's now trying to acquire a national news title in the UK. Mm. I won't say which one, but he has the ambition and I assume the funds to buy a national news title. And as I say, he's launching this new movement which will either replace UKIP or assist it electorally. What's very pertinent in this case is that I'm told that Theresa May has taken the decision to hold a snap election in the spring so that she has a mandate. Now, given that Parliament is sovereign in this matter, according to the recent court decision, it means that in the spring we're effectively going to have a second referendum in the guise of a general election. And the population are likely to vote candidates in or out, largely on the strength of their position on Brexit. So I think what you may see is the Liberal Democrats taking a lot of seats from the Tories in prosperous middle-class areas that are anti-Brexit. And Banks' new movement taking a lot of seats from Labour in the North.
Yeah, could I just interject? This new movement that you're describing being funded by Aaron Banks, do you see that as also having links to the Kremlin?
Well, yes. But the point about Banks is we don't know really where his money comes from. So The simple answer that he would give is that I've made many millions developing insurance companies and then selling them to investors, which is true. But his money and his business interests are centered on Belize and Gibraltar. And the way that I would describe it, it's like a bucket of water. If he has a liter in that bucket and some other mysterious figure pours another liter into it, you have a liter of water in that, 2 liters of water in that bucket, and it's one body of water, and its origins are extremely difficult to tease out. I wasn't an expert on electoral funding legislation before I did this report, but I looked into it and I found out something extraordinary. I'd always taken it for granted that foreign funding of British political parties is forbidden, and it is. But when you look into the regulations, a UK or European established company or an individual UK citizen can donate money to political parties without problems. But where it comes to companies, their beneficial ownership is irrelevant. So if Vladimir Putin were to establish a company in the UK and register it at Company's House, and he were 100% owner, there would be no breach of electoral law whatsoever. And so there are big holes in the regulations, and I would not accuse Arron Banks of anything, but what I would say is that where his money comes from is a mystery. You know, it comes out of completely opaque offshore centres. It seems to be practically endless at the moment. And I think that's a serious cause for concern, because the effect that he's had on the UK's destiny is hard to quantify.
So I think, to me, when I hear you describing these kinds of effects, and beyond Arron Banks, however, you know, the UK does seem to be relatively resistant to foreign influence from authoritarian regimes like Russia, at least compared to the kinds of institutional relationships Andreas has described and the sort of mainstreaming of the far right to some extent into the conservative right that Marlène has described as well in France. But going forward, it seems like you're describing a potential for more vulnerabilities and openings for foreign governments to take advantage of, you know, disenchantment with establishment parties, perhaps funding of movements as opposed to parties, et cetera. I guess we'll have to see what happens in the spring. I want to open the floor a bit more outside of Western Europe as well. We have Peter here and Josh as well. I think the elephant in the room is, of course, our own elections that we just had. You know, we, as analysts, experts on this issue, that have been following the rise of populism in Europe, have often talked about Viktor Orban, for example, who a personality you know very well, Peter, as you know, this very kind of potentially template-like leader for Central Eastern European countries, who tries to play both the West and the East, tries to roll back democratic institutions, while at the same time expressing a lot of admiration for authoritarian leaders like Putin, for example. Of course, we've had our own campaigns, and our president-elect has said very positive things about the Russian president as well. So what does this all mean? I think many of us here in the United States were confused about the elections and a new reality here, and we're still trying to understand what this all means for foreign policy. You know, Peter, you have gone through the Orban years. How do you see the situation in Hungary? Do you see any connection, you know, between what's happening in the U.S. now with the election of Donald Trump and what happened perhaps with the election of Orban? How do you see these new personalities? And is this a path that you see the region more broadly taking going forward?
Yes, I think you're completely right, and I think the report is right in that as well. So what we can experience in the whole Western world right now is, as Mitchell said as well, a populist zeitgeist in which forces that are criticizing the traditional elites, defined in a lot of separate ways, have some illiberal tendencies and have Russia as a role model of policies and ideology as well, are on the rise. And the question is that where this process will stop. We don't really know, given that we have elections next year in France, in Germany, in Netherlands, in Czech Republic as well. We will have one soon in Austria. And what I do think is that kind of axis, I wouldn't say that there is always a very, handbook, playbook, according to which these players cooperate. Populist radical right forces in populist leaders such as Orban, Donald Trump and the Kremlin, but this is an axis of joint interest, or this has been an axis of joint interest. I think the mere fact that Donald Trump became the president of the United States will change the rules of the game. But anyway, right now, what I expect, and it might be a very controversial statement, that there will be much more and deep changes as a result of the election of Donald Trump in Europe than in the United States, and these kind of populist right movements will gain a huge momentum. As for Viktor Orban, I don't know him personally as well, but there is someone in the audience who definitely does, the ex-charge d'affaires of the United States to Hungary, who Andrei Gutfreund, who knows him well, and he was in Hungary in a quite tense period between the US-Hungarian relations. And generally, what we can observe in Hungary is that right now, Viktor Orban, however irrealistic it sounds, have some messianistic visions of becoming the leader of Europe. And what he is deeply interested in is that the traditional elites in all over the Western world are swept away by the refugee crisis. And unfortunately, we are seeing more and more signs of that is happening. And Hungary is a very interesting case for the reason that I think it definitely has walks a few steps above the Western world in many, I would say, negative aspects. And Viktor Orban, for example, was one of the first leaders of the Western world, if we can say so, who endorsed Donald Trump in a period where nobody really thought that he will be able to win. And right now it's his victory as well. So I do think that what we can observe in Hungary, well, there is a pretty much pro-Western public opinion. We have just, we'll publish a public opinion poll soon that shows that among Central Eastern European countries, Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary, Hungary is the most pro-Western regarding the attitudes of the population. Still, we have a governmental party, Fidesz, that is pretty much aligned with Moscow, and also we have a far-right party, Jobbik, which is practically, we can say in this case, the puppet of Moscow with a member of the European Parliament, Béla Kovács, charged for espionage for Moscow. And similarly, as Aaron Banks, he has a Russian wife who has links to the secret services, Russian secret services. And his wife has three husbands, one in Hungary, one in Japan, and one in Austria, which is a bit, let's say, at least a bit strange from a party that traditionally promotes conservative values in family and elsewhere. So, and at this point, I would make a very slight disagreement with the otherwise, I think, perfect and very well-written report, the title itself, Trojan Horse, because what I think we can see in overall Europe and the Western world is that nothing covered about the intentions of a lot of players. Marine Le Pen, for example, openly praised Vladimir Putin, and vice versa. Vladimir Putin mentioned Marine Le Pen as one of the leaders of Europe, the future, promising future leaders. AfD has published its manifesto in German and openly targets the ethnic Germans in Germany and has a very blatantly pro-Russian stance. The UKIP was even quite well known for its pro-Russian stance. So all over Europe, I can see that it's not like Trojan horses, but a hostile army is just marching into the fortress and the gates are open. And this is the big problem, I would say, that that they should not even cover their intentions, and the voters, really interestingly, doesn't really care. The public opinion has shifted to a more hostile direction towards Russia, according to the researches of the Pew Research, for example, and still, it didn't really have an effect on the decision of voters in Hungary, in the UK, and right now in the United States. And this is an interesting question. Why is it so?
I think you're absolutely right. I think most of us probably agree with that statement as well. The gates are open. There's no need for Trojan horses anymore. That's a disturbing thought, but I do think you have a very valid point. Josh, so I have to ask you, you know, most of us have probably read most of your analysis in the Post during our campaign season as well. Does all of this matter? You know, we've been talking about how, this is out in the open, meaning the relationship between the Kremlin and these particular organizations, individuals, parties, groups, et cetera. There's no more need for things being opaque, perhaps, even the financial ties remain opaque. They don't seem to matter, electoral outcomes. There was a huge, obviously, media coverage of potential links between the Trump campaign and WikiLeaks and Assange and the Russian security services, et cetera. But that didn't seem to actually do anything, you know, in terms of electoral outcomes. So, you know, what's your take on all of this?
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for including me, and congratulations on the report. I think your question gets to the heart of it, which is, you know, it matters because while all of our European allies have been dealing with this for quite some time, for the Americans, it's new and interesting and very misunderstood, okay? And although in Washington we're aware of this sort of, you know, call it what you will, Trojan horse, I like to sort of think of it as low-intensity warfare. It's a combination of, you know, information operations, the weaponization of migration, the use of cyber tools, right? What the report accurately calls active measures, right? And this switch from sort of classic espionage to active measures happened in Washington and in the United States at the time, at the most hypercharged moment in our politics in recent history, okay? And because this was done in sort of, and exposed to the greater American political consumer class, in this sort of haphazard and misunderstood way, it resulted in the issue just being completely, you know, sort of chaotically misrepresented by all sides in ways that are really damaging to the discussion. So I think the report has the basic role of being able to educate people about this, and which we badly need. But let me take you through why I think this was so mishandled during the election. And each of the actors has a different responsibility. For the Trump campaign, and we can get into the sort of details of the links, which I happen to have done a lot of reporting about, it was more of a sort of tactical, convenient decision to sort of, first of all, deny that these things were happening, then embrace the information that was leaked, and then sort of, you know, use that to come up with a thinly veiled sort of, you know, outreach to a new relationship with Russia that we're now seeing play out in the transition, right? So for them, it wasn't really about the U.S.-Russia relationship. It was about their short-term goal of winning the election, which they did. For the Democrats, you know, and who were mysteriously all of a sudden on the anti-Russia side of the issue, they were forced to sort of, you know, I think what they did is they overreacted, and they actually went beyond the facts. And, you know, I found myself writing defenses of the Trump positions on Russia because the Democratic, Hillary Clinton's political team actually, you know, leaned so far into this that they not only damaged the credibility of the argument by, you know, putting people out there like Harry Reid to say things that weren't true, they politicized it because anything that they were going to lean on was going to get politicized. And then the Obama White House, you know, for basically, besides confirming the fact that Russia was doing these things, which was a very labored over decision, really hasn't done anything. They reoriented very late in the game the U.S. intelligence apparatus to sort of look at these things, you know, a day late and a dollar short. But their calculation was that any more aggressive measures to counteract these Russian influence operations, which I do believe, and most people who I talked to the intelligence community, believe did have some effect, it's impossible to know how much effect, on the election, would only escalate and potentially worsen the problem before the election. They also have this, you know, bureaucratic process that's not suited to these things, that wasn't nimble enough to react. And they figured Hillary Clinton was going to win anyway, so she would just take care of it. And they wanted to leave her a range of options, right, to do that, so she would have some leverage, et cetera, and all of that went away. You know, I think, you know, listen, you know, the optimistic view is that now that Trump is in, he's going to learn all of the information, he's going to become educated on these issues, and then wise advisors are going to steer him towards more realistic policies that acknowledge the facts of Russian interference in the U.S. political system and the U.S. information environment, and then respond to those, right? That's the optimistic view, right? Here's the reasons that that optimistic view might not pan out, right? He doesn't trust the intelligence that's given to him, right? He has different priorities, right? For him, this might just not be at the top of his list. If he can join with Putin to kill ISIS, then all this stuff may be, you know, not as important. And he has a fundamentally different worldview. And that's what I think what, you know, is the big elephant in the room, is that if Donald Trump himself wants to realign U.S. foreign policy towards a more pro-Russian, less European-centered stance, he has the power to do that. And none of us in this room is going to be able to stop him. And the most, I think the most scary part is that, you know, when we talk about, you know, I think it's absolutely true that all of these groups in all these various European countries have their own agendas, their own, you know, constituencies, their own funding. It's a complicated tapestry of interests. But, you know, Trump's chief strategist, Steve Bannon, is in the process of aligning himself with all of these movements in real time. We can see it happening. It happened today. It's going to happen yesterday. It's going to happen tomorrow. Right? That's a game changer, okay? And if the Trump administration starts cutting out what we consider to be mainstream political parties and focusing on these groups, I think exactly as you said, these groups are going to receive huge boons into their popularity and their resources. And I think that's the thing we have to follow the most. And I think I'll stop it.
No,
there.
Thanks, Josh. You know, I can't help but thinking from all the comments that, you know, from you about there being a potentially profound shift in worldviews based on the leaders we have elected in this country, but also in Hungary, potentially with the elections. I mean, I don't know if Le Pen will win the French elections, but she's certainly not projected to enter the second round of the presidential elections in France. In Germany, we don't know if Merkel's going to stay or not yet. Of course, in the UK, Neil, you described this similar dynamic of movements challenging establishment parties. And in the entire EU, in the European Parliament as well, Mitchell, as you talked about, there are individuals who are advocating very aggressively and have disproportionate representation in the European Parliament compared to their national parliaments in pursuing a pro-Russian agenda, if you want to call it that. But what I can't help thinking, are we going through a profound paradigm shift? I know this sounds a bit jargony, but are we going through a rethinking of the international order as we know and such as a result of the elections, the prominence of these leaders who see Western democratic models as no longer the fait accompli for the West? I'd like to hear all of your thoughts on this. I know we have some time constraints, but, Peter or anybody who wants to take that.
I may maybe Michelle. Just start and say a couple things. I mean, one of the things that most strikes me about this change in worldviews is that the key issue, it seems to me, from Trump and from his people around Trump is not Russia. I think this was said before. It's not Russia. For a lot of us, and you know, as Mitt Romney famously said, Russia is the big strategic threat, right? For, I think, most of these people that we're talking about, it's radical Islamic terrorism, right? You hear them say this all the time, right? That is the key strategic threat. And basically, all the policy, the worldview is sort of a shift towards this global war on terror perspective, where Russia is not really a threat, Europe is not really a big deal, right? The Middle East is a big deal, ISIS is a big deal, you know, refugees coming, you know, into the country, particularly from the Islamic world, who are sort of ticking time bombs of terrorism in this perspective, you know, terrorist threats like in France, right? That's the biggest issue. Now, security experts can debate this, and I've heard plenty of security experts say that really the threat that's posed by ISIS to the United States is not very significant, compared to the threat that Russia could pose to the United States, because they can blow us up, they can reduce us to ash, as you know, one of their politicians recently said. So from a security perspective, I think that's the paradigm shift. Mm-hmm. I think these people are serious about this. I think they see that as a threat to religious values. They see that as a threat of terrorism that plays extremely well politically. I think they see it as a threat, an economic threat, a threat to the community, to the nation. And so I think that's really the paradigm shift that's happening. And I don't know that it's going to be that easy. So I'm not sure. Also, the flip side of it is I'm not sure how much it's a threat to liberal democratic institutions per se. Right. To some extent, they may feel that they're protecting liberal democratic institutions. Right. But by cracking down on sort of human rights and civil rights and you know. Taking a different perspective on race and religious issues than has typically been associated with liberal democracy.
Yeah, so the shift you're describing is this focus on security. You have to make alliances or partnership with unsavory characters, then be it, right? As long as we're still fighting terrorism, quote unquote, whatever that means, ISIS, et cetera, then that's the real shift that's happening now. And I know, Josh, you have a comment, and then Andreas and Peter.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would just say that if you listen to what Donald Trump says, and if you believe that he means what he says, the paradigm shift is this. It's that, you know, now, you know, the U.S. government will deal with foreign policy issues on a state-to-state level exclusively, right? He's promoting the sovereignty of the state above all else. You can call that classic realism, whatever. I'm not an academic. Term it what you want. But it basically means that each sovereign state has the right to do whatever it wants inside of its borders without much criticism or interference from the U.S., and then the U.S. will deal with those states on a one-on-one or maybe occasionally a multilateral basis. Now, what that means is that, you know, for the next 4 years, forget about the sort of push for liberal democratic policies, human rights, the freedom agenda that we saw in the last Republican administration, or even the push for universal rights that we saw in this administration, okay? Where it's basically a blank check to any of these leaders, whether they be good or bad. Now, Trump doesn't make a distinction, right? Assad is bad, but he gets to run his country, and, you know, the leader of Turkey is bad, and he gets to run his country, but the leader of Egypt is, you know, whatever it is, it doesn't matter because he doesn't believe that the United States has a right or a role to play in interfering. So I think that's a right. Big paradigm shift that you
Yeah, and that came out on the call, of course, between Putin and Trump. What we heard about is that they supposedly agreed to non-interference in their own domestic affairs. Right.
It's very Chinese of them.
Indeed. Andreas, do you want to comment on this?
Yeah, I find it difficult to sort of think of all the parallel things that are going on at the same time in domestic affairs in major Western countries and in the international relations between the Western countries and the West and the non-West. But the two areas which I've observed a little bit and where I see maybe chances to keep some sort of continuity with the current world we're still living is German domestic affairs and also the, as I would see it, at the end of the day, the Russian-American relations. So for German domestic affairs, I would say that, you know, in lots of countries, things could change next year. I don't think that there will be a major change in Germany, I hope. You know, maybe I'll be wrong. It's simply, so far, it's inconceivable that there will be a principally new coalition. The most likely outcome will be a continuation of the current coalition, probably with Chancellor with Merkel again as Chancellor. There could be new, let's say, terrorist attacks in Germany that would delegitimize Merkel, and if then Merkel does not become a candidate for the chancellorship, then I would still think of the CDU again being the leading party and providing. Providing the chancellor. There's also a slight chance that there might be a Christian Democratic, Liberal Democratic Green coalition. It's called the Jamaica coalition in Germany because the flag of Jamaica has green, black, and yellow, the colors of these three parties. in it. So I would say that I wouldn't expect there a major change. I think this is going to basically going to stay. Concerning the Russian-American relationship, I would think that the ultimately most important thing is Ukraine, and the issue that in 1994 Ukrainian territorial integrity became a sort of an appendix to the non-proliferation treaty. And Mitchell said that for the new administration, ISIS and Islamic terrorism is going to be the major issue. You could argue that non-proliferation is even more important because it's a more existential threat. And because I think Putin, at least, will not give Ukraine Crimea back, and therefore this issue is sort of undermining the non-proliferation regime, you could make an easy argument about that it's in the core American national interest to remain critical of that and not to let this sort of and to keep sanctions and so on, because otherwise then the whole non-proliferation regime becomes ambivalent, and then in 10 years some country in Africa or in Asia may think, well, you see what happened to Ukraine, all these paper, that doesn't really matter. What we need is the bomb, so to say. And that is actually something that even for the US could be an existential security issue. So I would think if you argue it rightly, then there can be no appeasement of Russian annexation and expansion, because if anything, this is the most important international treaty, at least for the US, maybe for humanity, and its integrity should be kept on.
Well, I theoretically agree with you, of course, but practically, I'm not sure that will be the case, to be honest with you. Unfortunately, I think it's very unfortunate. There's a lot of discussion, a bit off topic of our current panel, but there's a lot of discussion now about this idea that Trump, who sees himself as a deal maker, will be willing to strike some sort of grand bargain with Putin, and Ukraine will likely be the victim of that grand bargain. And what we see now happening in Syria, of course, as of yesterday, right after that phone call, I don't know if there's a relationship there, a connection, we have Russia resuming airstrikes against Aleppo and civilian targets. And I hope that President Trump will listen to those intelligence briefings and we'll see Russia for what it is, which is Russia is not first and foremost fighting ISIS and terrorism in Syria. But I think in the current context, when we have this turn in the towards a pro-Russian agenda across Western, Eastern, Central Eastern Europe happening now, and could happen in a much more profound way in 2017, as all of you have discussed, that could lend a lot more legitimacy to weakening sanctions, for example, in exchange for something in this grand bargain. So we'll see. I mean, sanctions is another issue that is outside of this discussion, but that's going to be obviously a very interesting thing to follow. Marlene, I want to give you a chance to comment, and then Peter and Neil.
Yeah, just very briefly, I think you have a deeper shift going on in Western public opinion, both in the US and probably even more in Europe, which is really questioning the Western democratic liberal model as being able to continue to offer social justice, jobs, and welfare state in a globalized world. And I think it's a legitimate questioning coming from a large part of the Western societies with really doubts. And the problem is that as we don't have any more kind of big leftist ideology to offer a kind of projected idealistic solution, then if there is nothing to come and all the doubts are there about the ability of offering kind of social long-term development, then the solution will be coming from illiberal movements. So I think it's really a deeper shift coming from all the Western societies.
You're absolutely right. I completely agree with the rise of populism, primarily in the right, but also on the left. It has as much to do with the failure of the center-left to provide a convincing narrative to people who are feeling grievances and anxieties about their economic situation. We have seen this in our own elections, where the Democratic narrative obviously did not really confront and address the very real anxieties of the American working class was feeling about their future prospects. So Peter and then Neil, and then we'll open up to the audience.
Just three short points following up mainly on what Andreas and you, Alina, said. Yes, I think there is a rhetoric that is about let's make friendship out of the hostility. But if we think back that what the previous presidents tried to do. George W. Bush promised a reset of Russian relations. Was he succeeding in that? No. Also, Barack Obama promised a reset of the relations. Was he successful? No. Right now, Donald Trump promises a reset of relations. Will be he successful? I think no. And not because of the United States, but because of the fact that I think Putin is just not interested in having a friend in Washington. I think he is interested in having an enemy in Washington. If we look back on the previous years when Putin's popularity was on the rise, there were two major moments. One was obviously the Crimean annexation. The other one was the Syrian intervention. So I think it highlights us that these provocations and constant conflicts are part of the strategy. And I think more and more Putin will test the waters and provoke Donald Trump. Russian diplomats were really, really reserved in reacting to the Russian elections. Yes, there was the big applause in the Kremlin. We all seen that. But I think most of the Russian diplomats said that let's wait and see. And I think Putin was even reserved. I don't think they really want to make a big friendship. And just following up on Andrea's point, I do think that yes, increasing conflicts in Europe would be against the vested interest of the United States. And I don't want to be very, very apocalyptic, but let's think back to the 20th century. Both of the world wars were started in Europe. So if you support via Breitbart and other networks a populist movement in Central Eastern Europe, hoping that you will have more allies, finally you will have more chaos in Europe. There will be more conflicts in Europe, and who knows what comes. And finally, it's maybe the United States again that has to interfere and who wants it. So I don't really think it's the vested interest of the US. And the last point about the human rights, I think that totally abandoning the human rights rhetorics and paradigm would backfire as well, because the human rights paradigm, I think, has been a rather successful soft power tool in the hands of the US administrations. And a lot of human rights organizations all over the world, why they are sometimes criticizing the United States for some issues, sometimes with it's totally justified, sometimes it's not. But totally abandoning these organizations who are the biggest representatives of the US values in a general sense, a very general sense in Europe, I think it would be a mistake as well. But I'm not in the position to advise the US government, but a lot in the audience, I think, are.
Yeah, but the point you make about conflict anti-Americanism serving a very key role in Russian policy is absolutely right, because if you look at Russian media, they've been warmongering for a very long time, and that's a way to consolidate national identity and nationalism more broadly, which I think Putin deeply, deeply needs to sustain his approval ratings, which as far as we can tell are legitimate ratings, if you can call it that, in a place that has completely state-controlled media. Neil, I want to give you the last word before we take it to the audience.
There are two brief points. I think on Putin's eternal conflict and crisis with the West, it is the fuel for the engine. But in the short term, a deal with Trump could also be fuel for the engine, in that Putin can say, we're sitting at the top table, we're receiving respect in the gangster sense, and that they can bank some winnings, including the recognition of Crimea and the cessation of sanctions. But that will only last so long, and then probably in the medium term he'd revert to the crisis model and start to crank up the confrontation again. The second point I want to make briefly is that, Marlene, you said that movements in Western countries and political parties and players who align themselves with Russia in some way are not necessarily in the Russian camp. They have their own identities and interests and outlooks, and it suits them ideologically or opportunistically to align with Russia. And I think that's undoubtedly true. They're not Thunderbird's puppets controlled from the Kremlin, but But these are intelligence operations that we're talking about. And the Russians will not give money or render assistance to foreign politicians without gaining objective proof that this has happened and keeping it on file. And once you've accepted that money or assistance, you're never free again. And it can be brought up later to expose you to general dishonor or possibly prosecution. And it means that these politicians who've done anything remotely covert with the Russians are in the position of, for example, people in Central Europe who were collaborating with state security in the communist era and then go into politics or journalism after 1989. And the Russians come and knock on their door again and say, look, you're compromised. We need this from you. And they're not really in a position to say no. So in other words, they may not realize it, but they've made a Faustian pact.
Thanks, Neil. So I'm sure we could talk about these issues quite a lot, but I do want to open up to the audience. So if you have a question, please raise your hand. And when you ask it, make sure it's a question and identify yourself. So I'll take a few all together. So Ariel, then the gentleman in the back. Is there another? Not yet? Okay. So Ariel, please.
Good morning, Ariel Cohen, Atlantic Council. We are describing a relatively new battlefield. What should be the strategies in terms of response? Are these counterintelligence strategies? Are these banking regulation strategies? Are these political strategies? Are they media strategies? Who do you think should direct it? Should it be nation-state focused or transnational? And what is achieved so far and what should be done? Thank you.
Thanks, Ariel. Let me take another question. I saw a hand in the back, and I'll take a third here, and we'll let you guys respond.
Mitchell Pullman, I'm a freelance writer. I was wondering if one of you could comment on, isn't this ultimately about making the world easier for money laundering? I mean, this is really about the ability of the Kremlin, the Putin and his cronies, to smuggle their wealth abroad and be able to hide it. Trump properties, you know, in New York and Miami have been popular places to hide wealth. It would seem to me that this aspect probably is of greater importance to the Kremlin than any sort of ideological or geopolitical struggle.
Thank you. And I saw a hand here as well, so please just wait for the mic.
Andre Goodfriend, Department of State. Views I'm expressing are my own, and it's nice to see my friend Peter Krakow. Your fascinating paper and discussion. A question first. Looking at at Russia and how it changed from the Soviet Union, and the growth of identitarian populist politics there as a way to regain its strength or what it saw as its place. You'd noted that it's maybe not Trojan horses. Perhaps, though, they were drawing on the pre-existing movements in Western Europe, the nationalist movements that existed there, and saw this as a way to be part of this club, at which served then to, you know, as it grew stronger and started funding it, to destabilize the West. But recognizing, too, that this is populist, which means that it, as Mr. Barnett was saying, this move towards movements, this move towards towards reaching out to people and shifting opinions there, rather than working with parties, rather than working with states, becomes an important aspect of it, building up grassroots support. Looking at the recommendations in the paper, most of them are on shining light on what's taking place, or funding different organizations, taking things at a state level, but very little about building grassroots, very little about trying to have an understanding of what the importance of the Western values are, as opposed to shining light on what's taking place, because, as I think was also said, light has been shown, and the public has not shown that it cares. So how do you build that grassroots understanding?
Thank you very much. So we have a question on what should the policy response been and what has it been? And then we have a question on money laundering, which I think, Neil, given the UK, I think it would be interesting to hear from you on that. And then the last question on the grassroots response. So Josh, you want to take one of those on the policy?
Yeah, I'll take
and then Mitchell and
Neil. Full disclosure, I'm not actually a policy guy, but I do play one on TV. I have extensive thoughts about what we should do to respond to what all of these active measures, right? But, you know, in the end, first we have to make a national decision that we want to, okay? And before that happens, nothing else will happen, okay? So that's why we have to wait for this administration to shift out. But it seems to me that if we do decide that we do want to push back against this, there are some very simple, broad things that need to be done first of all, right? Fix the intel, okay? You've got to reorient this $80 billion intelligence apparatus to better analyze, be on top of this. That means repairing human networks. That means getting more assets into cyber, right? And that means like shifting from something else to this, okay? That's number one. Number two, we have to fix our public broadcasting and public diplomacy. There's no way to combat what's a very sophisticated state-run propaganda effort from Russia with the current Broadcasting Board of Governors. It's really a mess due to mostly neglect and mismanagement. And that's $1 billion a year right there that we could put towards this effort. So that's gotta be, you know, top down, just reorganized and rededicated to a mission that makes sense, okay? The next thing we have to do is fix the relationships with industry, right? The reason that all this stuff works is because the relationship between our government, our intelligence agencies and the companies that are operating the space, the tech companies, the social media companies, is terrible, okay, due to encryption and all that stuff, all right, and the Snowden disclosures. Okay, it's fine, we gotta fix that, okay, and the way that we do that is by, you know, coming to some agreement with all of these companies on, A, how to filter misinformation, disinformation, propaganda out of our, you know, free information space, how to distinguish between one and the other. We have to work together on that. That relates to terrorism too, but it also relates to this. You know, and then, you know, we have to set basic principles for how we're gonna respond, right? There are going to be covert operations and sort of espionage, traditional espionage that should be responded to in a covert and way, and there are gonna be these active operations that should be responded to in a more overt way so that people know that we're responding. And these should all should be framed around the basic tenets that we use for any other type of warfare, which is to clearly identify combatants, use proportional responses, all of that stuff, right? So you have to take what we understand as the right way to conduct warfare and apply it to these new battlefields.
And again, all this hinges on political will. So I could ask you, all of you, just keep your responses brief so we can get to more questions. So I know, Mitchell, you had a response, and Andreas, and Neil. Merlin? Mm-hmm. Okay, and then we'll take another round.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about political will for a second. So, Ariel, when you ask your question, to me, that's really a jarring question for me because it completely contradicts my understanding of what's going to happen in this administration. When you ask we, I'm wondering who's we. I mean, what we are going to do, in my opinion, is we are going to cozy up to the Kremlin. We're going to take deals. We're going to get paid off. We're going to promote Russian propaganda, right? Through Breitbart or wherever, we're going to use whatever RT concocts, you know, and spin that out. So, you know, I think that it's we're actually, you know, I mean, I could be wrong about that, you know, that's not really going to be happening. But if you look at it, I mean, the very first foreign European meeting that Trump had apparently was with one of these Trojan horses who's in this report. I didn't realize that this guy was along with Farage. You know, the Trump himself appears not to care about that. In fact, has quite a different attitude towards this. So I think how I would respond to what we should do, two things. One is we have to try to find a way to convince the Trump administration not to give away too much to the Russians in this honeymoon period they're going to have. Right, that's a key first step. Right, because the way the Russians, it seems to me, negotiate is, you know, and you already saw this in Kremlin's approach and in Putin's approach, is, well, here's a laundry list of like amazing things you could do that would make us happy. And all of these are sort of long-term things like accepting Crimea, you know, annexation, other things. And what we'll do for you instead is sort of not be so angry, which is something they can turn on and off, you know, like any second, right? So I think that we're vulnerable to giving away too much, either as payback or for Kremlin support for the campaign, or just as sort of general good feeling that U.S. presidents seem to have when they come into to office about Russia. The second thing I think we need to do is get prepared for when the administration gets turned off by Russia or begins to feel that it's safe to try to deal with Russia in a more serious way, to have a series of policy proposals on the table that they could deploy at that future point in time, while girding ourselves for the fact that this is not realistic for the near term.
Yeah, and the new administration will likely get burned by Russia at some point, even if there is a cozying up. But to me, it's also not clear, because none of us really know, and in many ways, what the policies will be. We just have little snippets of quips and things like that. You know, what do we want from this grand bargain, right? Like, we know we have leverage, the sanctions, perhaps. We know Russia has leverage in Syria, in Ukraine, but what does the U.S. get out of this grand bargain? I think it's the bigger question that's going to be answered.
A great question.
And so, Andreas, I know you wanted to comment, and then Neil, just if you could keep it pretty brief, because I want to take another round of questions.
Yeah, as I indicated before, maybe one should sort of reformulate these some of these sort of world political issues in terms of national security, because there's often, I see that in Germany or in other countries, that there is this sort of different ideals, and you know, we should support Ukraine because it's about the European values and democracy and support this revolution. But as I indicated with the Non-Proliferation Treaty, it actually concerns, you know, everybody's national interests. Or you could, you know, I have a somewhat similar cynical view of Putin, like Peter Krakow, who said that, you know, Putin needs the U.S. as a conflict partner, as a sparring partner. He needs Ukraine either under his control, or Ukraine being in a crisis mode, or even collapsing. So if he cannot get it under his control, then he would like to trigger a collapse of Ukraine, because that would be probably would create some problems also for Russia, but it would be for the regime extremely good to say, you know, that happens to you if you democratize and have color revolution. And so on. And then this becomes a national security interest for the European countries. So you have 45 million people there. If the state collapses, maybe 10 million will flee. Where will they go? You know, and then you can ask. So what? You know, you could ask Germans or Romanians, how many 100,000 Ukrainians are you refugees? Are you going to host? What are we going to do with the four nuclear power plants in Ukraine? Among them, the largest one in Zaporizhia, which is quite close actually to the current combat zone. And then you can argue for things like investment insurance, which George Soros proposed for Ukraine, lethal defense weapons, maybe some sort of East European security structure, maybe in the future when the Russians agree a UN peace mission for the Donbas. You know, then you can talk about the instruments. But first, we have to start, I think, with national security interests of the nations in question, and link them to Russia, and then I think we can change this discourse.
And Neil, do you want to pick up the money laundering question?
Yeah, I think it's a very sorry. It's a very good question, and you know, the general menace of opaque offshore structures and money laundering is one thing, but in terms of this this report, so I mean, I think, you know, as I said earlier, the fact that Aaron Banks put in $10 million into Brexit from opaque structures in Belize, of all places, is absolutely extraordinary. I mean, it was 52% to 48%, and he brought in Goddard Gunster, who came up with the immortal slogan, take back control. I mean, it was that close that I think that actually Banks' intervention may well have been crucial. And really, nobody's really asking the question, where did this money come from? But at another level, there's a parallel in funding with the rise of movements, which is the rise of something in the UK which is equivalent to super PACs. Funding organizations that do the party's work for it, but aren't covered by party funding regulations, which are quite new in the UK. And the one in my section of the report that I highlighted was right-angle campaigns where Robert Halfon, the deputy chairman of the Conservative Party with responsibility for funding, had until 2 months after the election this company, Right Angle Campaigns Limited. Two of the other directors were lieutenants of Dmitry Firtash. How much money went through the books of Right Angle Campaigns Limited, what it did, whether it indeed had any function, who knows, but the circumstances are extremely suggestive. And so better regulation of offshore centers and dirty money would cut down the opportunity for this kind of activity, and better electoral funding regulation, which acknowledges that not all political funding money goes into parties, would be useful too.
And also add to that question, you were framing the question whether or not all of this is really about facilitating a pro-money laundering environment. I think that's a secondary goal. I think there is the ultimate aim, which from my view is to weaken European transatlantic consensus and solidarity on a Russian foreign policy, is to weaken NATO, and is to weaken the EU more broadly. And as a secondary, you know, plus a little benefit, oh, well, you can also launder your money and buy real estate in London or New York or elsewhere and keep these loopholes open, et cetera. So I see that as a secondary goal. When Neil describes things on the policies, will go a long way in closing some of those loops. And I think, did anybody want to take the question on grassroots? What do you do about building sort of bottom-up consensus for, I guess, values and principles versus the top-down policy recommendations? Merlin?
Yeah, well, I think that's a core question. I don't think fighting back really makes sense. I mean, you want to protect sovereignty and have your intelligence operation being functional. But for me, the real issue is to reduce our own vulnerabilities by solving our own kind of issues. So for me, I mean, if you want to reduce Russian influence in France, then reduce the National Front influence. If you want to reduce it, then work on domestic issues to solve that. You don't need to really focus on Russia's influence itself. You need to focus on the real issue that makes us vulnerable. So for me, it's much more kind of a domestic solution. It's our own weaknesses that are used by external actors, and Russia is not the only one. I mean, we could also discuss Saudi Arabia, Qatar, money involvement, and so on. So there are many Trojan horses trying to enter, but it's because we have our own vulnerability. So the solution is on us, not on fighting back against the others.
Yeah, and Josh was also making that point. I mean, this report really focused on political relationships, but of course, that's just one part of a broader issue that we're seeing, where authoritarian regimes or other types of regimes are using what we see as virtues of open societies, like plurality, free media, things like that, to implant themselves into the politics and polities of those societies. And the way to respond to that is essentially what I think you and Josh were saying, is you strengthen independent media, you strengthen investigative journalism. But again, that all comes down to the willingness of governments and foundations and other actors with resources to support these kinds of efforts. I want to take a few more questions if there are any. I see a gentleman in the back there. So it has to be the last round. So one, two, three. So please just wait for the mic and introduce yourself very briefly.
Thank you very much. Good morning. My name is Zsolt Hetesi. I'm the deputy chief of mission at the Hungarian embassy. I would have some comments about Professor Krakow's vision on Hungary, but I will keep that for myself since this event is not about Hungary. But I was bothered by one of your comments. It's kind of an apocalyptic vision on hostile forces marching into the fortress with gates open. And especially that you have said that there might be a messianistic vision or goal for Prime Minister Orban to take down the establishment powers, the traditional parties. Now, as we all know, Fidesz, the party of Prime Minister Orban, is the establishment party in Hungary. I mean, it has a history for 27 years. This is as long as our democracy. I don't really see how it would be in the interest of Prime Minister Orban to take down traditional parties and establishment parties, especially taking into consideration the fact that the far right is losing ground in Hungary. So is there a contradiction here? Thank you.
Thank you. I saw another question on this side. Yes.
Nick Schwartz, U.S.-Ukraine Foundation. As Mr. Rogan noted, the Kremlin has an extensive and mendacious propaganda machine. What role do those mechanisms play in creating this pro-Russian sentiment, not just in the political landscape, but on a grassroots level? And as a quick follow-up, what can the EU do better to combat Putin's propaganda? Thank you.
And last question on this side. Yes.
Hello, Yulia Zhichkova, the Institute for Human Sciences, Vienna. I have the following question. While deliberating on bilateral relations, I mean, U.S.-Russia relations, you say that the reset of bilateral relations have never been successful. So I'm not intended to speak about the failures that both Russia and the U.S. Have made. But the question is the following. What are the prerequisites, conditions that could be considered as successful for the reset of bilateral relations? It could be under Trump or somebody else.
So the question is, what would be the conditions for successful bilateral relations?
What are the prerequisites or conditions for an official or effective or successful reset of relations?
Got it. So I think there's a direct question to you, Peter, on Orban. So do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, sure. Thank you very much. I think it's a very good and important question. I think one of the big reasons for the success of Viktor Orban is that he could achieve to channel the anti-establishment sentiments that are absolutely present in Hungary towards the European Union. And I, when I talked about messianistic visions, I didn't talk about the domestic political ambitions of Orban. I mean, it's his third political term right now. I think he pretty much knows what is it, how is it works governing Hungary. I think, on the other hand, you can say it's a bit, let's say, speculative, that that he has more ambitions. He's a political animal. He wants to have a higher position. And that, and when he said, for example, in his Béltusnád speech, that what we can observe more and more is that the previous black sheep are becoming more and more the leader of the herd. Second, he said that he feels more and more that Budapest is becoming the capital of Europe instead of Brussels. I think he revealed his ambitions to have some kind of European leadership. And I would say so. He has a good political, as a lot of populist leaders, he has a good political instinct. And I think he feels the zeitgeist. We don't know how far it will end, but I'm pretty sure that Europe will look different a few years ago, and he will find more and more allies in Europe, what we could even see in the last 2 years. So he's not a totally isolated leader as some of commentators depict him.
And Neil, you want to come back to this?
Yeah,
Hungary?
I mean, just to speak briefly in Orban's favor, which doesn't really come naturally to me, I think it's fair to say that the Hungarian political landscape has become so odd. It's canted so far over to the right now with no real center-left opposition that what Orban is doing, while his relationship with Russia is deeply questionable, he's continually trying to outflank Jobbik because they're the main opposition. And so I think a lot of what he does, including the refugee referendum, is just a domestic political management scheme to keep Jobbik out of power. And I have to say, maybe better the devil you know in Hungary.
Thank you. Josh, do you want to take the media question?
Sure. I mean, I have to tell you, I've been doing this for about 12 years now. I've never seen a more sort of chaotic and really, I'm not using this word lightly, frightening environment for journalists. And, you know, this was, again, hyper, you know, sort of accelerated during the campaign because the Russian propaganda and the alt-right media had a marriage of convenience, right? And they were promoting each other's disinformation and conspiracy theories to an amazing extent and corrupting the public understanding of basic issues and really beyond any recognition. And if my Twitter feed is any indication, it's working. And there are now millions of Americans who are just convinced that the reality of the situation is not what it is. And add to that now that we have the president-elect of the United States as recently as today, tweeting missives to further undermine public confidence in major media institutions, okay? Unprecedented, okay? And, I don't think that necessarily any one of these actors has thought through the implications of this, or if they have, it's even more sinister, And, you could call it the mainstream media, what I call the professional media, people who are independent and working to, do journalism in the public service, speak truth to power, afflict the comfortable, and comfort the afflicted, they're under attack, okay? And, in the end, the consumers have a vote here. So go out and buy a subscription to the Washington Post, please.
And I would also add, I would actually add to that in the media very, very briefly, that this is actually one space where I think we are moving, so slowly, from the policy perspective, are moving towards countering, responding, getting ahead of Russian propaganda. I think those efforts are still relatively nascent compared to how much the Russian government has invested. But there are these emerging strategic communications task force units within the EU, within various national governments. We've been working on this at the Atlantic Council quite extensively. For example, the Czech government, despite everything that may be going on there, is establishing a strategic communications unit within the Ministry of the Interior that's relatively large and well-funded. Again, these efforts are still relatively new, but we are moving forward on this, and many other organizations have been following the information warfare, if you want to call it that. But again, I think Josh is right. We have seen this emergence of fake media, propaganda, disinformation, not just coming from Russia, but from other sources as well, that are, I think, sowing a lot of mistrust in our mainstream media as well, right?
Right, and let me just underline my point, is that what's new and devastating is that this strategy is now being perpetrated from the biggest bully pulpit right. there is, which is the White House briefing room, okay? And the president-elect's Twitter feed, okay? So that's a game changer, okay? Yep. He's intentionally undermining American confidence in the American media, right? And there are very few things a strategic task force can be able to do about
that. Absolutely. And I want to give everybody else a quick opportunity to respond either to the media question, to Hungary, or to this question of what should be the preconditions for successful relations. And I think, Andreas, you had a point, and then I'll give you Mitchell and Marlene and everybody else another chance to respond.
Yeah, my answer is going to be about this issue that the gentleman from the US-Ukraine Foundation asked, how should we respond? What I've observed in Germany is that although Russia has put a lot of efforts to improve its image in Germany, actually over the last years the public image of Russia and especially of Putin has gone down, and it's now mainly concentrated on the far left and far right. What Russia is trying to do is not anymore, I think, to such a degree to propagate itself and to put itself in a positive light, but to question, people like Peter Pomerantsev have described it, to question the Western order. And as I indicated before, what we have to do in response is not only to improve our domestic and international Western order, but also to go back to the reasons why the EU and the NATO have been established, and the EU is now associated very much with economic issues and refugee rights and so on. But the initial impulse for it was to
to secure peace in Europe with these economic interactions. We've seen how the EU has now been able to preserve peace in Yugoslavia. I would argue that if the EU had given a EU membership perspective to Ukraine in the association agreement, Yanukovych would have been forced to sign the association agreement in Vilnius. I think it would have been domestically for him very difficult not to sign an association agreement with a membership perspective. And we didn't do that, and that's why then the whole country got into disorder and opened this window of opportunity. The same, I think we should argue, we can endlessly argue about, liberal values and all these, and American domination and so on. And Russia is trying to promote this picture of the West as promoting gay rights and sort of anti-traditional values and so on. But this is not actually the initial impulse of either of the EU or of NATO. These organizations were created, as I already said, out of national interests. And we should sort of reconnect, the value of these organizations for the individual countries. And then we could say, well, yes, I mean, you may not like it, but, for us, the EU has produced peace. For us, NATO has produced security. And that's why we need it, and not for gay rights or something like that. So I think that should be the response just to this sort of attempt of Russia to portray the West and its international relations as decadent.
So, and final, very quick, very running up over time. So I want to give everybody just a quick chance to say a few words, either to this last question on bilateral relations or something else that you want to comment on. So Neil, Mitchell, Marlene, and everybody else.
In terms of... In terms of the response and countering these various phenomena which are happening at the same time, I just want to say something about intelligence, which is that I think our intelligence organizations in the West are misconfigured in a sense. In the Cold War, they looked through a telescope at some very narrow things like Soviet war planning and intentions and so on. And there's this obsession with developing human sources, which is all well and good. In the post-Cold War era, this is in a way narrowed further into counterterrorism, Islamic extremism. And there's two problems with that. They're having a lot of trouble in retargeting onto Russia and associated threats. And second, even if you retarget, if you're still looking down a telescope and trying to recruit small numbers of human sources, you're missing the bigger picture, which you'd see with a wide-angle lens. And the British Army now has a concept of human terrain mapping, because what happened in Afghanistan was that they were concentrated on finding Taliban units and commanders and eliminating them. But they missed the general point that they were losing the war with the Afghan people, and that they didn't have a broader awareness of the situation because they were looking through a telescope. These phenomena are so broadly based that you need an intelligence organization that can draw in a lot more information. Some of it secret, some of it electronic, some of it open, and form a holistic picture. And I don't think we have that right now.
Okay. Thanks. Mitchell, very briefly.
Yeah, I'd just like to respond to I think it was the woman from Austria who asked, what could we do to really improve in a durable way U.S.-Russian relations? And, this has been a project of not just Donald Trump, but also a project of Barack Obama when he came in with the reset, and of George W. Bush before him, who looked into Putin's eyes and saw his soul, and he thought it was great at the time, and it turned out not to be so great afterwards. If you look, we don't have much time, but if you look into what it was that broke down those, relationships in the early of these administrations, it was that, ultimately it can be summed up that Russia wants to take us down. Russia does not want the U.S. to exercise a leading role in the world. And it tends to see this as a zero-sum game and is trying to undermine our power, essentially. And under those conditions, it seems pretty hard for any president to try to really improve those relations in a durable way. I mean, I think it was also said here, I agree that, you know, that Putin, to build his own strength, he's playing the Soviet playbook, to build his own strength and allegiances at home, he needs an enemy, and the U.S. is the convenient enemy. And so under those conditions, very hard to see how this can be durable for really anybody, however hard you try.
Right, and I think we could have a wish list of what Russia should do to correct its quote-unquote bad behavior. Like, it could pull out of the Donbas, right? It could give Crimea back mm-hmm. to Ukraine. Mm-hmm. It could stop bombing civilians in Syria. But the point, as you said, Mitchell, and others as well, is that it's choosing not to do so. Mm-hmm. Right? And there's a reason for that. And it's exactly because there is a desire to keep the enemy relationship with the U.S. And Marlene, please.
Yeah, just very briefly on the media question, I think that we need to take a kind of broader view of what is happening with the media, because if we analyze the rise of the growing distrust of Western audience toward their own Western media as being just a kind of information warfare going on from unfriendly regime, then we miss the point, because I think the media landscape just totally changed so much. It's just the birth of social media, the fact that everyone is, there is no more legitimate voice in the media, the fact that now everyone can tweet and create a kind of echo chamber, it just totally changed the way individuals will be looking at media. So I think we just need to find kind of other solutions than just hoping to answer to the media, to the propaganda machine. We have studies, for example, showing that how conspiracy theories are developing in the Western audience. You can have someone in Russia or everywhere launching it, but then the way it works after, it's just a kind of also weakness or a change of our own society toward what is true and what is legitimate. So I think here also, Russia is just playing one card that is already there, but not creating anything really new.
And Peter, and then very, very quickly, any final words, Josh and
yeah, Andreas? I would pick up one point, the question of Andre about what to do, how to build up something grassroots that is interested or understanding the things that we are talking about here in this room, let's say in this bubble. And I think one, the crucial reason why the voters seem not to resonate to this issue of Russian influence is that they don't feel it on their own skin. And I think if beside what Marlene said, which is really important, that let's deal with the conflicts and problems that Russia wants to exploit, and then they won't have anything to exploit, I think the politicians should do more to explain the voters why some kind of influence from Russia are really malevolent for the Western world. And I would pick up on one point only, the refugee crisis. Anti-refugee, anti-immigrant forces in all over Europe are in a big friendship with Russia that is, by bombing Aleppo in itself, contributing to the huge flood of refugees coming from the Middle East. So isn't there a contradiction here that you have friendly relation with someone who is contributing to the crisis that you're against? And this is where I think Russia really has a strategy, given that we have all described, that they are interested in having some kind of chaos in Europe. And I don't think that the voters really recognize this kind of links. Okay.
Thanks. Josh, Andreas?
Yeah, I would just close by saying I do think there is still something called the legitimate media. I do think it's important and a vital part of our democracy, and I consider the pursuit of legitimate media to be in the public service. I don't think that the corruption of the understanding of what is legitimate media, which is pervasive, is solely the fault of Russian propagandists, although they play a role. I think there are also domestic forces at play. I don't think social media is the adversary. Social media is just a tool. It's human beings that use social media and consume social media that determine whether or not it contributes or detracts from the discussion. I think there's chaos in the journalism world because of all of these factors, but that there's also a settling coming, and all of us who take this seriously are working to figure that out now. A lot of it will be to take the financial incentive out of fake news and propaganda. A lot of it is just for money, okay? And once you remove the ads and the ability to profit off of fake news, and conspiracy theories. That's one part of the problem. The intelligence and propaganda is another part of the problem. The most tricky part is when, you know, you have the president-elect of the United States spreading conspiracy theories. I'm not really sure how to deal with that. We're thinking about that now. And in the end, you know, I trust, perhaps naively, news consumers to, over time, vet sources amongst themselves, vet publications, vet individual writers. It will take more responsibility and more education. And what the expert community can do is help legitimate journalists get legitimate information into their publications. And if you have any tips, I'm at josh.rogan@gmail.com. Thank you.
Andreas, final word.
I don't.
No final words, even better, because we're way over time. So thank you for your patience to Random Humans over time. And yes, please pick up a copy of the report. And thank you to my distinguished panelists and co-authors for working on this together. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Atlantic Council Events Podcast. For more information, please visit our website at atlanticcouncil.org and follow us on Twitter @AtlanticCouncil. The Atlantic Council, working together to secure the future.